What if I told you that every time you bring up your absolute happiest, most cherished childhood memory, you are actively destroying the original version of it?
I mean, it sounds like a glitch in the Matrix or something,
Rah!
or just, a really terrible biological design,
Right.
because we are so conditioned to think of memory as a recording. And you press play, you watch the tape, you press stop, and the tape goes back in the box unchanged.
Yeah, exactly. Like a perfectly preserved little file. But the reality of human neurology is so much stranger than that. And I think that brings us to the mission for today's deep dive. We're essentially dismantling this universally held myth about the brain, this idea that our memories are permanent, locked in recordings. And we're pulling our source material today from an incredibly provocative article in the OOTW Journal.
Yeah, it's called The Editable Memory, How Reconsolidation Rewrites the Past.
Right. And our goal today is to really explore the science of this phenomenon called reconsolidation.
Which is just fascinating.
It really is. It's the discovery that recalling a memory makes it temporarily fragile, like it physically unspools it.
Yeah.
And we are going to look at how understanding that one biological quirk could completely revolutionize how we treat deep-seated trauma, phobias, and, just emotional pain in general.
Because it's not just about forgetting where you left your keys, right? This is about the fundamental flexibility of human identity. It changes everything.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand why reconsolidation is such a mind-blowing concept, we kind of have to look at the stubborn scientific dogma that ruled neuroscience for, most of the 20th century.
Absolutely. The old dogma was so entrenched.
Yeah.
For decades, the consensus was just that memory was a one-way street. You have an experience, it sits in a temporary holding buffer, your short-term memory.
Right.
And then over a few hours, it goes through this biochemical hardening process.
And scientists call that initial hardening process consolidation, right?
It's exactly consolidation. And to give that some biological weight, we aren't just talking about a vague mental filing system here. Consolidation is a physical, structural change in your brain.
Like actual hardware changes.
Yes, when you form a long-term memory, your neurons literally manufacture new proteins to build stronger synaptic connections.
Wow.
They lay down physical bricks to bridge a pathway. And the old thinking was that once an experience went through that initial protein building phase, the cement had dried.
So the memory was installed, period.
Yeah. Sure, it could maybe fade over time if you didn't use it, or it could get buried under newer memories, but that original physical trace was thought to be locked in the vault forever.
And that was the absolute bedrock of neuroscience for a long
It
time.
was.
So to see why that entire model fell apart, we have to look at a genuinely heretical experiment. This was conducted by a researcher named Karim Nader.
Right back in 2000.
Yeah, in 2000, working in Joseph Ledoux's lab at New York University. And Nader essentially wanted to ask a question that most neuroscientists thought was just ridiculous. Like, what if recalling a stable old memory made it unstable again?
Which, how do you even test that? You can't just ask a person if their memory feels unstable.
Right. How do you measure that? So he sets up this experiment.
He uses a classic fear conditioning setup with rats.
Okay.
So Nader conditioned rats to fear a specific neutral tone. Every time the tone played, the rat received a mild foot shock.
Oh man, poor rats.
I know, but very quickly, the rat's brain associates the tone with danger. And a primal fear memory like that, it lives in a region of the brain called the amygdala.
Right, the fear center.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So after establishing this fear, Nader waited a full day. He gave the memory plenty of time to fully consolidate. The neurons built their proteins, the cement was completely dry.
Okay, so at this point, according to the old textbook dogma, that fear memory is a permanent fixture in the rat's brain.
Yes. But Nader did something new. He played the tone again to reactivate the memory in the rats.
Just a reminder, right? No shock this time.
Right, just the tone. But immediately after playing the tone, he infused a drug called annisomycin directly into the rat's amygdala.
Annisomycin.
Yeah, and annisomycin is a protein synthesis blocker. It stops the brain's ability to manufacture those physical bricks we just talked about.
Okay, wait, I'm trying to picture this. The memory is already built. The bricks were laid yesterday.
Right.
He plays the tone to make the rat think of the memory and then drops a roadblock on any new protein construction. What
The
happened?
fear was erased.
Just gone.
Completely. The rats went back in the cage, heard the tone, and behaved as if it had never meant danger at all. The memory didn't just fade, it was biologically dismantled.
That is insane.
And to prove that this wasn't just, the drug causing generalized brain damage or amnesia, Nader had a control group.
Oh.
Yeah. He took other rats that also had the fear memory, gave them the exact same protein-blocking drug, but crucially, he did not play the tone to reactivate the memory first.
Ah, so their memories stayed asleep in the vault.
Exactly. And for those rats, the fear remained completely intact. The drug did absolutely nothing to a closed memory.
Wow.
The fear was only vulnerable to being destroyed if it was brought to mind first.
That is wild. You know, the source article mentions this old analogy of memory being like a library where you pull a dusty book off a shelf, read it, and put it back unchanged.
Right, the classic view.
But reading about Nader's rats, I kept thinking it's less like pulling a dusty book off a shelf and more like opening a cloud document on your computer.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, because the original file doesn't just stay intact on a server somewhere while you look at a copy. Once it's open, the cursor is blinking, the ink is wet, and you actually have to hit save all over again just to keep it from deleting itself.
That is a phenomenal way to conceptualize it. The scientific term for that resaving process is reconsolidation.
Reconsolidation.
Yeah. Consolidation is the very first save. Reconsolidation is what has to happen every single subsequent time the memory is opened.
Wow.
The brain actually has to call it the exact same molecular machinery, the proteins, to rebuild and restabilize the synaptic trace. The memory drops back into a fragile, what neuroscientists call a labile state.
Labile, meaning easily altered.
Right. And if you interrupt that resaving process, the file corrupts.
I mean, I understand how that works mechanically now, but biologically, that sounds like a terrible design.
It does seem risky, right?
Yeah, why would evolution build a system that deliberately risks destroying its own precious memories every single time you use them? Like, if remembering where the water source is, or remembering that a lion lives in a specific cave is crucial for survival, unwinding that memory just to look at it feels like a massive biological flaw.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is actually a stroke of evolutionary brilliance. Reconsolidation is not a bug. It is the entire point of the system.
How so?
Think about the reality of the natural world. It is not static. The water source might dry up. A new predator might move into the territory. A memory you formed last year about what constitutes a threat might need immediate updating based on what you experience today.
Oh, I see. So it's about keeping the internal map accurate to the external world.
Precisely. By briefly reopening a memory whenever it is retrieved, the brain gives itself a chance to fold in new information. It allows you to revise the map rather than stubbornly clinging to a stale, outdated copy.
Yeah, it makes so much sense.
Yeah, memory is reconstructive specifically so it can stay useful and adaptive. But the cost of that incredible flexibility is that the memory is always, by definition, vulnerable to edits.
But this editability isn't a permanent state, right? Once you open the cloud document, you don't have the rest of your life to make changes. The article points out there is a very specific time-sensitive window.
Yes, the reconsolidation window. Research indicates that once a memory is reactivated, it remains in that fragile, labile state for roughly a six-hour period.
Just 6 hours.
Yeah, during those few hours, the synapses are essentially unglued. New information can be integrated. But after that window closes, the trace restabilizes, the proteins finish their work, and the ink dries again.
Okay, so injecting protein blockers into a rat's amygdala to erase fear is fascinating neurobiology. But we obviously aren't going to, you know, drill through a human being's skull to fix a phobia.
No, thankfully not.
So how do you stall the memory-saving process non-invasively in a person?
That is the exact question that drove a landmark human study from 2009, led by Meryl Kint and her colleagues in Amsterdam.
Okay.
They knew that the emotional charge of a fear memory, like the visceral physical panic, is stamped into the brain, partly through noradrenaline acting on the amygdala.
Noradrenaline being the neurotransmitter that essentially supercharges the nervous system. Like, it's the chemical highlighter ink that tells the brain, pay attention. This could kill you.
That's the perfect biological translation. So Kind's team decided to target that highlighter ink using a common, widely available blood pressure medication called propranolol.
Propranolol? I've heard of that.
Yeah, it's a beta blocker. People use it for stage fright, things like that. It safely crosses into the brain and blocks the receptors that noradrenaline usually binds to, effectively blunting the stress response.
So they aren't stopping the brain from building proteins like in the rat study. They are stopping the brain from encoding the panic.
Yes. So in their experiment, they had human volunteers learn to fear a picture of a spider by pairing it with a mild electrical shock.
Okay.
And they didn't just ask the participants if they were scared. They measured the fear using the physiological eye-blink startle reflex.
Which is like an involuntary biological flinch that you really can't fake.
Exactly.
You can't fake it.
I'm tracking. So they have a group of people who are now demonstrably biologically afraid of this spider picture.
Right. And the next day, they brought the volunteers back and briefly showed them the spider picture again, without the shock.
Just a reminder to reactivate the memory. They opened the document. They opened it. But this time, they gave them propranolol. So the reconsolidation window is wide open, but the drug is actively blocking the noradrenaline from re-saving the emotional weight of the memory.
Okay.
When they tested the volunteers a day later, the physiological startle fear response was completely gone.
Wow.
The biological flinch had vanished, and it stayed gone.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because I need to clarify something crucial here. Did they forget the spider entirely? Like, did the propranolol give them localized amnesia?
Oh, no.
Because if we're talking about erasing facts from a human brain, that's getting into some very dystopian sci-fi territory.
It is a vital distinction. It was not amnesia. The declarative memory, the factual content of the event, was perfectly preserved.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, if you ask the volunteers, they would say, yes, I know that spider picture means I'm going to get a shock. I remember the experiment yesterday. Mm-hmm. They consciously remembered the association, but their body no longer reacted to it.
The fact remained, but the fangs were removed.
Exactly. The factual file was kept, but the emotional grip had been completely rewritten out of the memory during that six-hour window.
That is staggering.
Incredible.
But, you know, let's take a step away from pharmacology for a second. Blocking stress chemicals with a pill is one thing. But what if you want to rewrite a memory without using drugs at all?
Right.
If the window just requires the memory to be open and malleable, couldn't we use pure information, like new experiences, to update it?
That's exactly the leap a researcher named Daniela Schiller made in 2010, working with Joseph Ledoux and Elizabeth Phelps. Schiller wanted to see if behavioral learning alone could hack the reconsolidation window. She used a clinical process called retrieval extinction.
Okay, just to make sure we're on the same page, extinction in this context doesn't mean deleting a memory, right?
Right.
It means repeatedly exposing someone to the thing they're afraid of, like a spider, but without the bad outcome. So the brain eventually learns the spider is safe.
Yes.
Hmm.
But here is the catch with standard extinction therapy. It doesn't usually rewrite the original fear memory. It creates a new secondary memory of safety.
Oh, I see.
So now the brain holds two competing files, spider equals danger and spider equals safe.
So they're just fighting it out.
Exactly. And that's why people can go through months of exposure therapy, feel cured, and then months later, a stressful event triggers a relapse. The old fear memory was just dormant, not gone.
The new safe file just lost out to the older, louder danger file.
Right. So Schiller's brilliant idea was to see if she could stitch the safety information directly into the original fear memory file so there wouldn't be two competing files anymore.
Oh, wow. How does she do that?
She fear conditioned her participants, and the next day, she reactivated the memory with a single reminder.
She opened the window.
Then she split the participants into two groups. One group was given the extinction training, so repeated exposure to the trigger with no shock, inside the reconsolidation window just minutes after the reminder.
Yeah.
She forced their brains to evaluate this new, safe information while the original memory was chemically unschooled.
And the other group?
The other group received the exact same extinction training, but hours later outside the window. Long after the original memory had restabilized.
I have to imagine it's day and night result.
Day and night. For the group that received the safe information inside the six-hour window, the fear did not return. They brought them back a year later, and the spontaneous recovery of the fear was still blocked.
That's amazing.
But for the group trained outside the window, the fear eventually came roaring back. Which is exactly what normally happens with standard extinction.
It really reframes everyday human interaction, doesn't it? I mean, think about what a really good session of talk therapy might actually be doing biologically.
Absolutely.
Or even just venting to a trusted friend after a really traumatic day. You're bringing a painful memory out into the open, making it labile. But because you are sitting in a safe room with someone who is comforting you, your brain is taking in that new safe information. And when the six-hour window closes, the memory hits save with that comfort and connection stitched right into the architecture of the file.
It is a beautiful way to understand the neurobiology of healing. The therapeutic act is literally the act of bringing a memory out of the vault and giving the brain something better to save alongside it.
Which brings us to what feels like the ultimate frontier for this science, applying it to deeply entrenched emotional pain, specifically PTSD.
Yes, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Because neurologically speaking, trauma isn't just a bad memory. To use an analogy, trauma chemically locks a memory. It's like trying to defuse a bomb while you're actively being electrocuted.
Oh, that's a powerful way to put it.
You can't learn that the wire is safe to cut because your nervous system is completely overwhelmed by the current. Trauma is a memory that reconsolidates badly.
That is the tragedy of the trauma trap.
The trauma trap.
Yeah, for a trauma survivor, every time they are reminded of the horrific event, the memory reactivates, the file opens. But instead of folding in safety, the person experiences a severe flashback. Their amygdala is hijacked.
Mm-hmm.
The system is flooded with stress chemicals, which essentially shuts down the prefrontal cortex.
And that's the logical part of the brain, right? The part that could tell them they are currently safe.
Exactly. So instead of updating the memory with new safe information,
yeah,
the memory gets re-stamped with overwhelming fear. The terror deepens. Every single time they recall it, they accidentally reinforce it. The mechanism that evolved to help us update our maps becomes an endless loop of re-traumatization.
That sounds exhausting. So how do we break that loop?
Well, this leads us to a fascinating hypothesis put forward in 2018 by Andrew Fiducia and Michael Mithofer regarding MDMA-assisted therapy.
Okay, MDMA.
MDMA is obviously a compound getting a lot of attention in psychiatric research right now, but they proposed a specific biological mechanism for why it helps trauma survivors, and it relies heavily on this reconsolidation window.
So how does it actually break the loop, like chemically?
Their hypothesis is that MDMA does something a simple beta blocker like propranolol cannot. It actively and profoundly changes the entire neurochemical state of the patient while the reconsolidation window is open.
Okay.
MDMA floods the brain with oxytocin, the bonding hormone, and serotonin. Crucially, it dramatically dampens the fear-driven reactivity of the amygdala while keeping the prefrontal cortex online.
So it stops the electrocution while you're trying to defuse the bomb. It creates this massive felt sense of safety and self-compassion.
Yes. So the patient, under the influence of the medicine and guided by a therapist,
mm-hmm.
is able to voluntarily reactivate the traumatic memory. They open the cloud document.
Right.
But this time, they aren't flooded with panic. The amygdala isn't hijacking the system. They are flooded with a profound sense of security. They can actually look at the trauma, process it, and when the memory restores at the end of the session, it fuses with this new, undeniable neurochemical state.
I am safe now. I survived.
Yeah.
So, what does this all mean? It means the trauma isn't deleted, the patient doesn't forget what happened to them, but the visceral bodily terror welded to the memory is loosened.
It gets refiled.
Right. It gets refiled in the brain as something that happened in the past, rather than a threat that feels like it is happening right now.
Yeah.
A memory that can heal is a memory that can be changed.
It's a paradigm-shifting hypothesis.
Oh.
It leverages the brain's own evolutionary updating mechanism to turn the trauma trap into an escape hatch.
It's incredible. Okay, but before anyone listening decides to DIY this and start trying to edit their own bad memories at home with pharmaceuticals, we definitely need to transition into the messy reality of human biology.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the source material provides some very necessary, honest cautions. There's always a catch, right?
There's always a catch. Reconsolidation is incredibly robust and reliable in a controlled rat lab. But human brains are infinitely more complex. The window doesn't always open just because we think about a past event.
Right. The article mentions boundary conditions. Why does a memory sometimes refuse to become labile?
Boundary conditions are basically the rules that dictate whether a memory will unschool or not. For instance, the age of the memory matters immensely.
Okay.
A memory from 20 years ago has extensive synaptic cross-linking. It's deeply entrenched across the cortex, making it much harder to destabilize than a memory from last week. And the strength of the initial emotion also plays a huge role.
That makes sense. I imagine surprise plays a factor too, right? Like, if you just sit in a room and predictably think about a fear over and over, your brain probably gets bored.
That's a critical piece called prediction error. If a reminder is entirely predictable, the brain doesn't bother opening the memory for an update because it assumes there's nothing new to learn. There has to be a mismatch between what the brain expects and what actually happens for the reconsolidation window to crack open.
So you can't just forcefully pry the window open by sheer willpower. It's an incredibly finicky process.
Which is why both Shillera's pure information study and Kainyo's propranolol study have faced replication issues.
Oh, really?
Yeah, some independent labs have reproduced the effects beautifully, while others have struggled to get the same clean results. The map of exactly when and how human memories can be reliably edited is still being actively drawn by neuroscientists.
And since we're talking about clinical realities, we have to touch on the guardrails around this. The idea that MDMA heals PTSD through reconsolidation is a brilliant, highly plausible hypothesis, but it is still just a hypothesis.
Yes.
It's not a settled scientific law. Things like overarching neuroplasticity and, you know, the deep trusting relationship with the therapist likely play massive roles too.
This raises an important question, perhaps the most important one philosophically, the ethics of memory distortion.
Oh, man, yeah.
If we acknowledge that memories can be intentionally updated, weakened, or fundamentally altered, we have to acknowledge they can be distorted.
Right. If you can chemically strip the emotional weight from a memory, where do you draw the line? At what point are we altering who a person fundamentally is?
It's complex territory. Deliberately altering human memory, even with the noble goal of relieving immense suffering, requires massive care. And as the source material explicitly stresses, compounds like MDMA are controlled substances with real physiological risk.
Absolutely.
These treatments require strict clinical supervision and carefully calibrated environments. This is absolutely not a tool for self-experimentation. Knowledge requires critical thinking, and we must avoid falling into the hype trap of thinking we've found a simple magic erase button for human suffering.
It is a delicate, complex tool, not magic. But even with all those scientific and clinical guardrails firmly in place, the core takeaway here is profoundly hopeful.
It is.
We are not carrying a life sentence written in stone. The past is not a fixed, immutable recording that we just have to drag behind us forever.
We are reconstructive beings.
Mm-hmm.
Our minds were quite literally built to update themselves. Under the right conditions, even our oldest, deepest wounds can be reopened gently, evaluated with new wisdom, and resaved just a little bit lighter than they were before.
It really shifts how you view yourself and your capacity to change. But, you know, reading through all the science about how every act of recall edits a memory, it left me with a final thought that I haven't been able to shake, and I want to leave the listener with it.
Let's hear it.
We've focused entirely on bad memories today, on trauma, phobias, and fear, but the biology of the reconsolidation window applies to all memories, which means if every single act of recall edits a memory, how much of our fondest, most nostalgic childhood memories are actually accurate?
That is a staggering thought.
Right. Take a happy memory you've told at dinner parties 50 times. Are you actually remembering the event anymore? Or are you just remembering the last time you remembered it? Is it just a memory of a memory of a memory? Subtly rewritten and shaped by the mood you happened to be in each time you told the story over the years. Like taking that old photograph out of the shoebox when you're in a great mood and accidentally painting a slightly brighter sun into the background before you hit save and put it back. What if our happiest, most cherished memories of the past are actually just as much a product of who we are today?
A beautiful, if slightly unsettling, realization. The ink is always wet.
Something to think about next time you tell your favorite story. Thanks for diving deep with us. Keep questioning, keep learning, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.